the book and to, you know, print the book. Sheikh Abbas Al-Qummi, he goes to the publisher and he takes the book back. And he tells him, I have to make some changes to it. I'll bring it back to you later. So the publisher says, okay, bring it back whenever you're ready. And inshallah, we will print your book for you. He goes and he takes it. And he does not go back to the publisher until one full year later. One full year he waits. And then he goes and he gives it back to the publisher. He tells him, now I'm comfortable. Now you could go ahead and print this book for me. So the publisher, he tells him, oh Sheikh, what happened? I thought you were going to go and come back a few days later, a few weeks later maximum, and then we're going to print your book for you. Why did you wait a whole year? He tells him, because my book is a book of dua. And I am telling people, I am giving people the guidelines and how to do dua throughout the whole year. So I figured that before I tell other people, let me tell myself. Let me come and implement what I'm telling people, and then I will come and give it to other people. My dear brothers and sisters, this is perhaps the reason why the book of this man, Sheikh Abbas Al-Qummi, the Kitab Mafatih Al-Jinan, is the most popular book of dua. Because it's a book that is pure sincerity. And the man did not do it for others. The man implemented exactly what he is telling other people to do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm your host, Saeed Bourizza. Before I bring you my panel, let's have a look at some of the latest developments. No let-up in apartheid Israel's attacks. Rescue efforts are ongoing after another night of Israeli bombardments across the Gaza Strip. The relentless shelling has displaced thousands of Palestinian families over the past 3.5 months, but their place of shelter is also turning into a war zone. In the south of the enclave, hospitals are under siege, with medical supplies running low. More than 27,000 Palestinians have now been killed since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli genocide. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the binding decisions of the International Court of Justice must be complied with. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh is in Cairo to review a 6-week ceasefire proposal forged in Paris over the weekend ahead of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's return to the region for further talks. Yemen says its naval units have fired several missiles at a U.S. Navy warship in the Red Sea. And Iraqi resistance forces have launched a drone attack on the port city of Haifa in the Israeli-occupied territories. Both those attacks aimed at stopping the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Well, joining me on this edition here in the studio, business owner and analyst Noor Fekri, and via Skype from Essex, organizer and activist Fatima Dasa. Thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Noor. Do you think, given what we heard right now, that we may be on the cusp of a ceasefire?
I do believe that we are very close to a ceasefire, particularly with the negotiations taking place. But again, we're not there just yet. There are certain criteria that need to be upheld for a ceasefire to take place. Yeah. So firstly, that would be for the complete withdrawal of the Israeli occupation forces from the Gaza Strip, and for them to cease, you know, wreaking havoc there. It would also mean that they would need a permanent ceasefire, which would mean not just for 3 months, which is what they're suggesting, and also for all of the Palestinian hostages to be released from across the Palestinian the occupied Palestine, and that includes the Palestinian hostages that are being held in prisons for some, you know, for decades, some of them children, minors. And so, if these criteria are not met, I don't believe there's going to be a ceasefire, simply because the Palestinian resistance holds the upper hand here. You know, the Israeli occupation entity has been talking about them, you know, having control over Khan Yunis 2 days ago, people, you know,
the claims of impending victory.
Absolutely.
Have not borne
out. 2 days ago, the Palestinian resistance from Khan Yunis, you know, fired rockets at Tel Aviv, which just suggests that they don't have that. They don't have the authority there.
Fatima, we're 2 weeks on from the International Court of Justice's interim ruling, and we're yet to see the Israeli regime make any moves to comply. Talk about what enables apartheid Israel to ignore international law and essentially get away with murder.
I think as we've seen for the last 75 years, it has had impunity against its actions. And it's very comfortable in that position. I don't think it's hit home for them what the ruling was. I was watching normal Finkelstein's coverage of the ICJ ruling, and he said you should have seen the shock on Malcolm Shores, who was the lawyer for the Israeli side, when the ruling about the provisional measures came along. You know, they couldn't believe it, that finally they've had the reckoning coming. So it's their impunity and the support of United States and the Western powers where it feels it can get away with murder, and up till now it has. And it continues since the ICJ rulings. You know, daily we are seeing 200 to 300 Palestinians being killed and massacred by the Israeli forces.
Anur, on the question of plausibility of genocide, according again to the ruling, that it basically said that it either has occurred or could occur, which means that the Israeli regime will not be able to shrug this off. Don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, it is already massively embarrassing for the Israeli occupation entity for them to be even be put on trial for genocide. I mean, that was established, this whole idea of the Genocide Convention was established post-World War II. So the irony in this is just, you know, mind-boggling. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation entity has, you know, proven time and time again that they are above the, you know, above international law. Is this exact international law that discriminates inherently against the Palestinian people? Mm-hmm. It is the UN that established and recognized this, you know, rogue, wrong and fake state as a state in the first place. And so, you know, it, to me and to many other people, whatever comes out of international law is pretty much void. But regardless of that, that still is a massive stain in history for the Israeli occupation entity. And it like I said, it will go down in history as a massive humiliation.
And by extension, for the countries that have backed it and armed it and given it diplomatic cover at international bodies over the decades.
Yeah, they are essentially complicit. It is the U.S. It is essentially a war that is backed by the U.S., a war that is actually managed by the U.S. You know, we know that the Israeli occupation entity makes no decisions if it's not for the U.S. Mm. If the U.S. called for a ceasefire today, this would be what would happen. And so it is these states like the U.S. and the U.K. are complicit in the genocide.
Correct. And Fatima, what Palestinians are going through, the ordinary people there who have borne the brunt of more than 3 months of incessant Israeli shelling. With your healthcare background in mind, tell us about the health risks that are threatening Palestinian lives in the Gaza Strip as we speak.
Well, I can't say better than a W Health Organization spokesperson, Margaret Harris. The combination of starvation, deprivation of food, fuel, and medicine, to top it where they've been bombarded, will lead to an absolutely dire humanitarian need for the people. What we're seeing is, in these sort of cases, the lack of basic necessities just furthers the humanitarian crisis. And one of the global health spokesperson, Yasser Asi, has said that this is a storm in the making. What we are seeing is a human-made humanitarian catastrophe. These are all preventable deaths. And in such cases, in a lot of these cases, unfortunately, disease kills more than the bombardment. In previous wars, like in Yemen, or in Darfur, what we've seen is that the lack of basic supplies, which is compounded in Gaza without humanitarian aid being allowed in, and 27 out of the 36 hospitals being flattened, that this then, you know, further where people are not able to access the basic needs. There's no food, there's no fuel. They're crowded in your small places, so infectious disease spreads like fire. It is really a recipe for absolute disaster, and this is what we are seeing. That is going to be going to kill more people than the actual bombardment. Actually,
starvation and disease, two things that are threatening millions of lives in the Gaza Strip. Now, as we heard earlier, the U.S. could end this with perhaps one phone call. As U.S.-supplied bombs continue to fall on Gaza, the White House has reiterated the Biden administration's commitment to a Palestinian state, a position that is vehemently opposed by Tel Aviv. U.S. State Department officials have reaffirmed the administration's position ahead of the fifth visit to the Middle East by Secretary of State Antony Blinken. On his agenda, helping to prepare the ground for post-bombardment reconstruction and governance in Gaza, as well as attempting to ramp up the aid response. Have a listen.
We have made quite clear publicly that we support the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. That's been the policy of the United States for some time. It's been the policy of this administration. You've seen the Secretary speak about it publicly. I'm not going to comment on the internal work that we do to advance that objective, but I will say that there are any number of ways that you could go about accomplishing that. There are any number of sequencing of events that you could carry out to accomplish that objective. And we look at a wide range of options, and we discuss those with partners in the region as well as other partners inside the United States government. But there has been no policy change.
All right. Let me continue this with Noor here. What do you make of the U.S. position on what's happening there? Nearly 4 months into the massacre, do you see any genuine change taking place in the way the U.S. has been approaching the genocide?
I mean, the U.S. in general have this position of thinking that they're cowboys, that they can sort of go across the globe and police the globe and bomb people into submission, bomb Yemenis into submission, bomb the Iraqis into submission. And so their position has always very much been similar, and they haven't really changed their position in terms of calling for a ceasefire. But this is the war that sort of changed all of this. You know, the Yemenis, for instance, proved that actually, you know, you won't be able to bomb us into submission. They have attacked warships for the first time in history. I mean, no one has ever dared attacking U.S. warships. And the Yemenis have shown that they, you know, don't actually care and are happy to do that, all for the liberation of Palestine. And so when it comes to the U.S. position, that doesn't massively change. However, it changes when their interests are affected. So, for example, take Ukraine as a case study. They have never gone in the trajectory of sort of negotiating with Putin, because it's not them that's dying, it's the Ukrainians that are dying. They don't care about the Ukrainians. They can die for all they care. But when it's U.S. troops that are being affected, when it's U.S. interests being affected, the Yemenis bombing their ships, they then,
the all-important global trade.
Absolutely. That's when they sort of change their position. And that's why we're seeing these negotiations taking place with, you know, Egypt and Qatar involved. That, to me, shows that the U.S. is in the trajectory of ending this, because it's seriously affecting their interests.
Very good point there. Fatima, this will be Antony Blinken's fifth visit since October 7th. Is this a case of the chief arsonist returning to the scene of the fire? As we heard Noor say, that the Americans who are actually directing this war have been since day one.
Yeah, absolutely, we can see. I mean, you know, on one hand, they're saying de-escalation, and you see cargoes and cargoes of weapons going into Israel. You know, in a matter of seconds, they can end this war. But you know, absolutely, they don't want to. Israel has been their baby for the last 75 years, and it is there is no will from them to end this war. They are going into it hook, line, and sinker, and they're actually escalating the regional war. We see that, you know, they bombarded Iraq, the Yemeni ships, even after the ICJ ruling, when they full well know that where they're aiding and abetting the genocide, they are also complicit in the crime. They've lost all credibility, absolutely, to be any kind of peace broker in this case.
All right. Noor, politically, where does all of this put the United States and its other allies, such as the UK, Germany? They haven't been able to. They have support their ally, Israel, in the region. The Israeli regime, with all that support, diplomatic, economic, and military, has not been able to subdue, as you say, or beat the resistance in the Gaza Strip. They're still there, but there's a lot of destruction, and as you say, they will be complicit in what has taken place there. Where does that leave the United States and its allies politically?
I mean, they are very quickly running out of time, and I think also running out of, patience for the Israeli occupation entity. They were given a certain time limit. We were told at the beginning that it was up until sort of the end of January for them to be able to achieve at least a single goal militarily, and they have failed time and time again to combat a small illegal resistance faction in the Gaza Strip. And let's not forget they're also under huge pressure from the northern front. With Lebanon, for instance, Lebanon has introduced new weapon technology with live camera footage that can record any target that it hits. And so therefore,
it's only half of it, by the way.
Absolutely. And so, they've proven time and time again that they're unable to do anything to sort of like minimize the strength of the resistance. And so the US and its allies are running out of patience. And you see that with, for example, David Cameron coming out and suggesting that, he might recognize a Palestinian state. And that could also be a sign of, trying to get at the Israeli occupation entity and let them know we're about to recognize...
Not get stuck in the quagmire that Israel is trying to pull them into.
Absolutely. So they're having to sort of change their position publicly, although, that isn't necessarily the case in reality.
Correct. This is Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourreza, where we shine a spotlight on the ongoing U.S.-Israeli carnage in the Gaza Strip. Support for Zionist Israel continues to dwindle amongst the Jewish people. Author and former academic Sabi Sagal told Press TV there are Jews like him who are proud of being called anti-Zionist.
I come from a Jewish family. My parents were Russian Jewish refugees from Nazi Europe. I was born in London. I was brought up in a very strong Zionist atmosphere. But I broke with Zionism at the time of the 1967 war, and I've been campaigning for Palestinian rights and freedom and national self-determination ever since. So I'm pleased to be called an anti-Zionist Jew. I think the creation of the State of Israel was a great mistake as well as a crime, and it inevitably resulted in the forced displacement, the ethnic cleansing of the majority of the Palestinian people, first of all in the Nakba of 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were expelled at gunpoint by Zionist militia, again 300,000 or so expelled by the Zionists in 1967. I see no future in the long term for the State of Israel. Israel claims to be a haven for Jews. In fact, statistically, since 1945, the country in which there's no country in the world in which more Jews have died for one reason or another, as soldiers or from terrorist attacks, than Israel. So far from being a safe haven, it has made it is a more dangerous place for Jews. It has not solved the problem of anti-Semitism. In fact, it has aggravated the problem of anti-Semitism. It has created more anti-Semitism because of what the Zionists have done to the Palestinians. I think the Jewish community is split. I don't know exactly the answer to that, but probably a majority would say they stand with Israel. But a significant minority is very disturbed by the actions of the State of Israel, by the IDF, would like to see would support the call for a ceasefire in Gaza, and would support, as I do, a one-state democratic state of Palestine, i.e. I don't know whether they would go as far as saying they support the dismantling of the State of Israel, but certainly they don't support the current status, political status quo.
Palestinians inside Gaza are reacting to the news that the UN agency that delivers the bulk of humanitarian assistance to the region could soon wind down activities after its largest donors paused funding. Israel's allegations that staffers of UNRWA were involved in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood led by the United States and several other countries to cut off funding and reignite a debate over Gaza's biggest humanitarian aid provider. For those already living under bombardment, the cut in services would be catastrophic.
I'm one of the people who do not have children to support me or a husband. I'm a widow, and without the food that we get from the agency, we will not find food to eat, and there are many widows like me.
The beginning of hell, because there are 2.2 million refugees, immigrants and displaced people from north to south, and these people are without shelter, food, drink or anything. And as you see, and as the world sees, if food is not available for these people, then we are heading towards a famine and a disaster that is the worst in the history of humanity.
Well, let's continue the conversation with my guests, Fatima Dasa and Noor Fakhri, with only a few minutes to go. Fatima, let me put this next one to you. What do you make of the more than 10 Western countries led by the U.S. suspending much-needed funds to UNRWA, even as full-fledged famine looms and before the outcome of an investigation by the U.N. into those allegations?
Well, I think it's a disastrous decision, but do you expect anything less from the Western hegemony that has aided and abetted the genocide in front of people's eyes? You know, it furthers the hypocrisy of the Western world. If anybody had any little doubt that what this what the Western world was doing in Palestine and what it was supporting Israel to do, the funding cut absolutely is the final nail in the coffin and proves what the Western powers are out to do. I mean, United Nations Relief Agency is the only most important and effective agency that is supporting not only the development, but also the distribution of aid. When has it cut the funding? When there is the most unprecedented need in the country. 1.9 million refugees have been displaced. We are seeing over 25,000 people killed, more under the rubble. Majority of the hospitals have been bombed. And this is the time, literally 2 to 3 days after the ICJ ruling, which is telling the world and telling Israel that you have to provide immediate and effective need to the Palestinian people. 2 to 3 days after, the Western world cuts the funding. And it's a coordinated and an orchestrated political attack on the relief agency. I mean, as we've seen, the Israel officials have been caught on camera, that for them to achieve what they are out to achieve in Palestine, which is the ethnic cleansing and the genocide of the Palestinian people, they have to get rid of this United Nations agency that is providing relief. So it's absolutely very apparent for people to see what the Western world is doing to the Palestinian people.
Noor, what is your take on this? Is this, as Fatima said earlier, a coordinated and orchestrated attack on UNRWA that came, we got a note, only hours after the ICJ ruling? I mean, you have a famine about to take place. This cutting of funding to UNRWA could mean certain death for a lot of people, thousands of people in the Gaza Strip, and yet it has been allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an attempt at discrediting the ICJ and an attempt at discrediting international organizations in general. I mean, because the ICJ ruled against Israel, they're attempting to discredit anything related to the UN. Before the ICJ verdict even came out, we had Israeli occupation entity officials coming onto British radio channels such as LBC and saying, you know, trying to discredit the ICJ before the verdict had even come out. And that just goes to show that how fearful they were of that verdict, mm-hmm. and rightly so. When it came out, it was against them. And even after that, they've tried to discredit this main international court. They've tried to discredit now, an aid organization that's again linked to the UN. So they will, you know, call anything and everything Hamas if that helps them. They'll call me Hamas, you Hamas, the building Hamas, everyone's Hamas, mm-hmm. as long as that you know, they're serving their own interests and as long as they're protecting themselves, even if it's from a humanitarian aid organization.
Mm-hmm. And the word humanitarian, at the top of the show, we talked about perhaps an upcoming pause in the U.S.-led Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. What I would like to ask you, Fatima, is what would be the point of a pause at this point when the population is displaced, the resources for reconstruction are practically non-existent? More than 70 or 80% of the housing stock in the Gaza Strip has been flattened in relentless Israeli bombardment over the past more than 3 months.
I think, you know, we all know a pause means absolutely nothing at this point in time. We absolutely have to have a permanent ceasefire with immediate humanitarian aid to go in. And also we need to have a long-term vision, because nobody's going to start building anything in Gaza if, you know, 2 months down the line, Israel comes in and starts bombing everything again. That's what we've seen in the past. You know, aid is sent in to build, Israel comes in and bombs the whole place again. So it's not going to achieve anything. The people that get involved we have to have a permanent ceasefire, and nothing else will be sufficient. And we absolutely have to have humanitarian aid to go in, because, you know, like you said, 70% of the structure is gone. This cannot be built overnight. It will take a long time to recover the infrastructure in the country.
Absolutely. And a permanent ceasefire is what the next national pro-Palestine demonstration will be asking for coming this weekend, one of many that have taken place over the past 3 months or so. Noor Fekri, Fatima Dosa, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us, and thank you. Gaza Under Attack will be back with the latest. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Analysis by Cancer Research UK has estimated that there are 33,000 extra cases of cancer in the United Kingdom each year associated with poverty and deprivation. While women from England's poorest areas die on average 5 years sooner than their wealthier counterparts. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Research suggests one in four economically inactive people live in the 50 local authority areas in England with the highest levels of poor health. The report published by the Institute for Public Policy and Research, Commission on Health and Prosperity, found a double injustice, where places with worse health also had lower levels of household income and higher rates of poverty. The analysis by the Office of National Statistics found that people living in England's most deprived local authorities were almost 1.5 times more likely to report economic inactivity, meaning they were not working, studying, or seeking a job, and twice as likely to be in poor health. The Institute for Public Policy and Research describes such areas as bad health black spots, where there was a correlation between high levels of poor health and economic inactivity. In the cities of Liverpool, Manchester, Nottingham, almost 1 in 10 people were in bad health, while more than a third of the population were also economically inactive. In contrast, less than 4% of the population in Hertfordshire, in Western England and South Oxfordshire, and in Wokingham were in bad health, while less than a fifth were also economically inactive. The places experiencing poor health and high levels of economic inactivity also have some of the lowest levels of healthy life expectancy in England, with Liverpool being 58 years compared with Wokingham, where the health life expectancy is more than 70 years. Efua Poku-Amanfo, the report's leading author, said that the research made the case for government spending and action on health. She said, "It's not just the morally right thing to do, it's the economically sensible thing to do. Bad health black spots, especially in the northeast and northwest of England and in southern Wales, are stifling national economic growth and holding back the wealth and health of the nation." The Institute for Public Policy and Research study from 2022 found that economic inactivity because of sickness was at its highest level since records began, with 2.5 million working-age adults inactive because of their poor health. A solution to the black health black spots proposed by the report were for the establishment of specific areas akin to clean air zones. These health and prosperity improvement zones would instead focus on improving key factors that affect physical and mental health of individuals. Dr. Luke Munford, senior lecturer in health economics at the University of Manchester and academic co-director of the Health Equity North, said that the report sheds more light on the interconnected nature of poverty, poor health, and limited economic prospects and prosperity. All three are deeply unfair and are all three cluster in certain parts of the country. Meanwhile, the Labour Party's deputy leader and shadow secretary of state for levelling up housing and communities, Angela Rayner, said the Conservatives' promise to level up is a scam and their 14 years of failure is damaging people's health and opportunities. A government spokesperson, however, claimed, "We are committing to increasing healthy life expectancy by 5 years by 2035. And narrowing the gap between local areas by 2030, including by investing up to £14.1 billion to improve health services and help people live longer and healthier lives." The government spokesperson said, "Our major conditions strategy will look at the prevention and management of conditions responsible for over 60% of ill health, and our plans for a smoke-free generation will make a significant difference with people in more deprived areas already twice as likely to die from smoking-related conditions." The government spokesman claimed, "Our Back to Work plan will also help a further 1.1 million people to look for and stay in work that's suited to their needs, including through integrated mental health support such as NHS talking therapies." The website Voxitic Polal Online has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to shocking new research by one of UK's leading public health experts, more than 1 million people in England died prematurely in the decade after 2011, owing to a combination of poverty, austerity measures, and the COVID-19 pandemic. The figures are revealed in a study by the Institute of Health Equity at University College London, led by Michael Marmot. They demonstrate the extent to which stark economic and social inequalities are leading to poorer people dying from cancer, heart problems, and other diseases. Using Office for National Statistics figures, the report's author, Professor Peter Goldblatt, looked at the life expectancy of people across England who do not live in the wealthiest 10% of the areas of England. The report, titled Health Inequalities, Lives Cut Short, found that between 2011 and 2019, 1,062,334 people died earlier than they would have done otherwise if they lived in areas where the richest 10% of the population live. A further 151,615 premature deaths were recorded in 2020, although this number was higher than expected because of the coronavirus pandemic. Professor Michael Marmot, who authored a seminal review into health inequalities in the United Kingdom in 2010, said the premature deaths and widening inequalities were a dismal state of affairs. He urged politicians to do more to tackle the fact that poorer people are at much higher risk of getting and dying from illnesses which are closely linked to poverty, poor housing and unemployment. Professor Michael Marmot said 1 million premature deaths made dramatically worse by austerity measures is shocking political failure. The worse health of the more deprived 90% of the population compared to the best off 10% means that health inequalities involve the majority of society. He added, if you needed a case study example of what not to do to reduce health inequalities, the United Kingdom provides it. The only other developed country doing worse than us is the United States of America, where life expectancy is actually falling. Professor Michael Marmot said, our country has become poor and unhealthy, where a few rich, healthy people live. People care about their health, but it is deteriorating, with their lives shortening, though through no fault of their own. Politicians can choose to prioritize everyone's health or not. Currently, they are not.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss different problems and issues parents might have concerning their children and teenagers. Well, in this program, our dear expert Sayyid Salman Naqavi is here with us, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa International University. Assalamu alaikum, dear Sayyid.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for accepting our invitation, brother.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The pleasure is all ours. Well, dear audience, in our previous episodes, dear Sayyid Salman Naqavi was talking about the effective way to communicate with our teenagers. Dear Sayyid, at your service.
Yes, thank you. So we were talking about effective communication with our teenagers, and we were mentioning the fact that the three stages that have been mentioned in the famous hadith that has been quoted from the Holy Prophet. It has been narrated that he said that there should be three stages in child upbringing, and
that's right.
And I was mentioning the fact that basically grooming of children to become submissive to Islamic teachings and to the imam, the system of wilaya that we have, we believe in strongly based on the Quranic teachings, that the Quran says they are innama waliyukum Allah, atiyu Allah. The first level is of wilaya, the wilaya of Allah Almighty, the sovereignty and the obedience that we have to give to him. Because the fact is that he is capable, he is competent, he is Allah Almighty is all knowledgeable, is all powerful. He has all these traits and attributes, so he's worthy of being obeyed. He's worthy of being worshipped. So that wilaya basis is based on competency. Allah Almighty has all the good attributes. He's all goodness, so we need to obey him.
Mm-hmm.
The Holy Prophet, Atiullah, Atiur Rasul, Atiur Ul Amr Minkum, or Nama Waliyukum Allah, wa Rasul, wa Lazina, Amen. So you have three levels of wilaya, starting from Allah Almighty, the Holy Prophet, the Imam. And this wilaya, institution of wilaya, has to be developed, has to be inculcated from the early childhood in our children.
That's right.
That system of wilaya, and that is based on competency. So we need to become competent. The parents are a sort of, an extension of that wilaya. The father has guardianship, has a control, an authority in the household.
We
have to become competent parents.
Uh-huh.
The father has to become a role model for their children.
To be deserved, actually, to be
obeyed.
And
they have to show that they deserve that.
Uh-huh.
By virtue of the fact he's a father, naturally, I'm the biological father of my son or my daughter, so that does not make me competent to become become a role model. I have to strive, I have to learn, I have to educate myself.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
To be an extension of that wilaya, so that I can inculcate that submission to the wilaya in my children.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to continue, start from the beginning of childhood.
Interesting.
And then it has to continue. And this is the first unit of the social fabric of our society. It starts with the family, with the household.
Yes.
And then maybe go into the neighborhood and go into the mosque, which is in the neighborhood. They also, that wilaya has to be extended, because when we talk about the imam of the prayer leader, unfortunately, we don't think of him in the fact that he is also a part of that social unit.
Yes.
That wilaya is an extension of the wilaya, extends into the mosque, and mm-hmm. it becomes the center of that social fabric.
That's right.
So they also, we need to take our children to the mosque to be able to engage. And the imam mm-hmm. of the prayer leader, he is also has to have competency.
Yes.
Not just reciting and offering prayers, in being a leader of the society.
Right.
The leaders of the society have to become prayer leaders. Not that prayer leaders have to become leaders.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important point.
Yes.
So, in the same sense that when we come to the household, even there, that inculcation of the imamah, because this is very important nowadays, today, in our situation which we live today, and we see this great upheaval coming over in the society, especially after what's happening in the West Asian hemisphere, and the upheaval that is going on, and the...
Yes.
The uprising and all the forces of evil coming together and the forces of goodness coming together under the banner of the leadership of the wilaya. It is
yes.
now very important that we inculcate this in our children, because we need to make them aware of the fact that they need to come and become soldiers, competent soldiers of in the awaited imam.
Inshallah.
So this is important. This is very important. We are able to communicate with our children effectively to show them what they want, what we want, not because we want it, because Allah wants it. So this
yes.
is very important. Communicating, being able to make them make the proper decisions, not imposing upon them. We need to maintain our calm. When can we do that? When we feel that what we're doing is something for the sake of Allah, not for our own satisfaction.
Yes. Thank you, dear Sayyid Salman Naghavi. Dear audience, we are going to be right back after the break. Stay tuned. This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. You're still listening to the program Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. And dear Sayyid Salman Naghavi, the faculty member of Al-Mustafa International University, is talking about how we can have a competent child.
So we need to, as we said, remain calm. We need to be curious, not furious. And we need to empower them. We need to make them feel that they have self-esteem and they have respect. And
Their cup full, maybe.
Yes, we need to make them feel that they can make proper decisions. We need to make them trust them and, you know, convey this confidence. If we start telling them off, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Start yelling at them, criticizing them. That's not going to make them give. They're not going to become having people having self-esteem.
Yes.
So we need to empower them to make them feel confident about themselves, make them trust themselves. We show to them that we trust you as human beings. You are independent human beings. We need to make them, even if they do something wrong, there are two ways of saying. You say, for example, why are you late from maybe school, or maybe at school somebody tells them of the teacher, why did you come late? Or you can say, today you are late, yesterday you were late. Can you, you know, sort this out? Can you manage how to do it? Do you have an idea?
Is there a problem? Can I help you with this? Uh-huh.
But you need to figure it out yourself. The child needs to know how to correct that behavior. Instead of saying, start waking up early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Start doing this. No, what is your idea about it? How do you think you can rectify it? What is your opinion? Make him get to the solution himself.
Uh-huh. This is the way actually we mean by advising.
Yes. So when they make the decision and they're not able to rectify it, the consequences will be their own. They will face the consequences. They feel the punishments or the reward in either case. So these are 3 points. Remaining calm. Don't be furious. Number 3, empower them. Make them
self-confident
in making the right decisions and facing the consequences themselves. And then don't make them feel that you're dependent on their behavior. Because if, for example, they feel that we're doing something just because our parents want us to do it, they want us to behave in such a way. So they feel that because a parent would like his child or her child to be an extension of their behavior, they want to see them in their own image.
Yes.
They want to see their children reflect their
own. As their mirror, actually.
Exactly. So they want to, maybe for their own reputation, for their own self-esteem, for their own image, they want to show that my children are like
the one who reaches their own ambitions, maybe.
But what will happen is that the teenager will now, if he starts behaving as you do, it's not because of his independent thinking. It's because of he wants to make you happy, or maybe it's an extension of that. And there's he will feel guilty. You will feel guilty. You will feel bad if he doesn't do what you're doing. And then if the child and the teenager realizes that by doing something which I don't want him to do, I'm making my parents feel bad, then he will, you know, continue to do that. He will make me feel bad all the time, and I can't tell him off. Because now I feel that he's conflicting with me, and I can't tell him off now because I had imposed it upon him. It was my thinking, not his own independent thinking. So in that case, he will know that you are desperate.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk more about this issue after the break. Dear audience, so stay tuned.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back to your audience of IRIB English Radio. You're still listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, and dear Sayyid Salman Naghavi is helping us to have an efficient teenager. And in this way, one of the guidelines is that we have to take care not to make our teenagers feel that they can control us through their behavior. Dear Sayyid, let's shed more light on that.
We think of them as images, as extensions of our personality. Yes. And we want them to behave as we do. Mm-hmm. So we impose what we want them to do instead of making them independent, instead of letting them make their own decisions, instead of making them to face the consequences of their actions, instead of making them confident and trusting themselves. We start imposing upon them. Now, when the child feels that way, now he understands, if I do something good according to my father's or mother's wishes, he or she will become happy. Yes. And if I don't do that and I misbehave, they will feel bad about it. Now, when that realization comes into the mind of the child, he can now manipulate the behavior of the parents.
And actually he tries to manage the behavior of the parents.
He knows if he does something good, his parents will react in a good way. If he does something wrong, their parents will react in a negative way. Mm-hmm. So now the child will be able to control
the behavior. He has something to control,
yes,
to manipulate.
So and he knows that if I don't go to school or if I don't get good numbers at school,
one who suffers is my mother or my father.
She's desperate that I get good numbers. She's desperate that I get a good position at school. Mm-hmm. So it's not me she cares about. She cares about herself, so let me manage her. So this is important that we don't get into that, you know. There's an oscillation between the two. There's going and coming back between these two behaviors. So we need to remove that. We need to break that vicious cycle.
Uh-huh.
And the teenager, he or she wants to manipulate and do what she likes. So we don't want to make them feel dependent. How do we do that? As we said, we need to communicate in an effective way. I mean, if we want them to do something good, then we need to make them realize that they have to be doing it according to their own decision.
Uh-huh.
They should think that it is good. They should feel that they need to do it. They should feel that if we do it, we'll get the rewards. If we don't do it, we will get the
punishments.
Mm-hmm. Not me as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
I am just here to guide you and tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Allah Almighty.
Yes.
Just like Allah Almighty. Allah
Almighty. Right.
It doesn't make
beautiful
any
example.
Difference for him. His
whatever we do refers to us.
Yes, it refers to us. The rewards and punishments are for us. Yes, mm-hmm. He has made the system.
And the point is that he does not let us actually be completely free. He's giving us guidelines.
Exactly.
He tells us what is true and what is wrong. And the one who decides is me or you.
Feel free to make the correct decision.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something what we expect. Allah Almighty says, this is how I behave with my creations.
Servants.
He wants
and now you treat with your children this way.
Also, treat your children the same way.
Okay.
Show them the path. Tell them these are the consequences. You are free to make the choice.
Yes, yes. Thank you, dear brother Salman Naghavi. And thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was a beautiful and fruitful discussion. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram, typing Call of Islam Radio. Well, until another episode, have a nice time and goodbye.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.